Many of us will be familiar with the Bloody Mary urban legend. The idea that if you look into a mirror and say her name a certain number of times, a malevolent phantom known as Bloody Mary will materialize to murder you. Some might say that the movie series The Candyman borrowed the concept, having the protagonist stare into a mirror while repeating the titular character's name as a means to summon him. It's certainly a terrifying trope, the idea of staring into a mirror, only for someone or something to suddenly appear behind you. It's enough to make even the bravest of us shiver. But no one's ever just appeared out of someone's mirror to murder them, right? Those of you who wish to remain in blissful ignorance, I implore you, stop listening right now. But for the rest of you, who don't mind being a little paranoid for the next couple of days, let me introduce you to the story of Ruthie Mae McCoy. At around 8:45 on April 22nd of 1987, Ruthie Mae McCoy made a 911 call from her 11th floor Abbott apartment on West 13th Street, Chicago. After the police dispatcher asked Ruthie what manner of assistance she required, he found her response to be incredibly perplexing. In effect, Ruthie told them that someone was trying to get into her home via the bathroom cabinet. "They want to break in," he asked. "From where?" "They want to come through my bathroom," Ruthie replied. "I'm on the other side. They're trying to reach in through my bathroom cabinet." The dispatcher had already established that Ruthie was on the 11th floor of a 13th Street high-rise. There was no way anyone was climbing through her bathroom window, and absolutely no way of them using her bathroom cabinet as some kind of doorway. The dispatcher was most certainly concerned for Ruthie's safety, but it seemed to them that the biggest threat to her well-being was herself. She sounded frightened, that much was certain, but if she truly believed that people were trying to break into her apartment through her bathroom cabinet, she must have been having some kind of mental breakdown. The dispatcher told Ruthie that the cops were on their way, but he logged the call as a disturbance with a neighbor as opposed to an assault in progress. It wasn't a high priority call, but the cops would get there eventually to check up on her. When the cops finally arrived at Ruthie's apartment, they knocked on the door but received no reply. After their knocks went unanswered, the police attempted to enter the apartment using a key given to them by an attendant in the housing office, but left when the key failed to unlock the door. The next evening, Chicago PD received a call from one of Ruthie's neighbors who was worried about her whereabouts, considering she had seen police at her door the night before and still had not seen Ruthie. Chicago police and Chicago Housing Authority security guards arrived back at McCoy's apartment shortly afterward, and after the knocks and calls for McCoy went unanswered, officers suggested breaking the door down, but unbelievably, were prevented from doing so by the CHA security guards, who told them they'd sue the city for damages if they got fired from their jobs. The following evening, pressures from the cops forced the Chicago Housing Authority to act, and they sent over a representative with a carpenter, who drilled the lock on the door. It was then that they made a horrifying discovery, the dead, decaying body of Ruthie Mae McCoy. Homicide detectives discovered that she had been shot in her left shoulder, left thigh, the right side of her abdomen, and right upper arm. It also became obvious that whoever had shot Ruthie Mae was known to her and was able to gain access to her apartment without breaking and entering. Yet they discovered that Ruthie had locked her door from the inside and the key was still on its hook near the threshold. So how had they gotten in and out of the apartment? Detectives reviewed the 911 call Ruthie made on the night of her death. When she mentioned her killers trying to get in through the bathroom cabinet, a deep chill fell over the two men. It was impossible, like something out of a horror movie. But there had to be a rational explanation for what Ruthie was saying, as she was obviously not imagining anyone in her mirror. Detectives returned to the scene of the crime, intent on fully analyzing this bathroom cabinet that Ruth had mentioned. To the naked eye, it appeared to be a regular bathroom cabinet. Mirror door, sterile white insides dotted with cosmetics and medicines, There were no secret doors inside of it, and there were certainly no supernatural portals to hellish otherworldly realms. In a show of mild frustration, one of the detectives either shook or struck the cabinet, only for each of them to notice something curious about it. It visibly shifted. We can imagine the moment. One detective silently looking at the other with surprise, before returning to shift the cabinet again. Before long, they discovered they could do more than just shift the thing. They could remove it entirely, revealing a gaping hole in the wall. As it turned out, the ABLA projects, which Ruthie called home, had a rather unusual architectural quirk built into it, in that certain apartments connected to one another via a narrow tunnel that ran behind the bathroom cabinets of opposite apartments. This design was intended to provide easy access to plumbing fixtures if maintenance was ever needed. In some cases, apartments above and below each other were also connected by similar means. Granted, this made tradesmen's lives much easier, but also provided easier access for burglars and also nefarious types, as the bathroom medicine cabinets were easily removable from each end. A person could simply remove the cabinet from the wall of the apartment they were in, crawl through the narrow passage known as a pipe chase, and push in the cabinet of the unit they were trying to access. Break-ins via this method have been going on in the ABLA projects for quite a while by the time of Ruthie's murder, to the extent where residents would put furniture in front of their bathroom doors or tie them with rope before going to bed. It was obviously a huge problem, but one that was completely overlooked in the construction of the housing projects. Until the Chicago Housing Authority could find the money to fix it, residents were told to simply make do. Ruthie's apartment, number 1109, happened to be connected to number 1108, and this is obviously where her killers emerged from. Number 1108 was indeed being rented at the time, and it's believed that the tenant on record was actually a drug dealer who allowed his customers to use the apartment as a drug den. These shady drug-using types must have either entered or heard about the flaw in the architecture and decided to use it to their advantage. Two ALBA residents, Ted Turner, then aged 18, and 21-year-old named John Honduras, were charged with murder, home invasion, armed robbery, armed violence, and residential burglary. A number of witnesses claimed they saw the two men carrying McCoy's 19-inch color TV and rocking chair around the projects in the hours following Ruthie's murder. After years of arrests and continual investigation, the charges against the two men were dropped due to lack of investigation, and the Ruthie's killers were never officially charged or imprisoned. Even without the supernatural element, the idea of someone being able to violently break into your apartment via what amounts to a secret passage is absolutely terrifying. Very few of us ever seen the blueprints to the apartment buildings or houses that we live in, and even fewer are actually interested in doing so. And so how do you know for certain that there isn't some kind of secret entrance to your apartment? And if there is, how do you know there isn't someone sneaking along it right this instant, ready to jump out on some poor unsuspecting scary story fan to give them their own personal horror story? The man born as Frank Rushon would eventually go by Andre Rand during his adult life, but the name on his driver's license has become somewhat irrelevant, as his terrifying exploits would be attached to a deceptively playful nickname. Born in New York City on March 11th of 1944, Rand would spend most of his life around Staten Island, going on to be one of the most infamous criminals that the Northeast has ever known. And although Rand definitively wasn't the most prolific serial killer, it's more the nature of his crimes that made him so universally reviled. You see, Andre Rand's prey of choice was children. Thankfully, Andre Rand is currently serving several consecutive 25 years to life sentences, but the convicted kidnapper and suspected child serial killer managed to wreak enough havoc and inflict enough pain in his time that his capture and imprisonment provides very little solace. Yet bizarrely, the man's morbidly fascinating tale began as a real-world campfire story. In days gone by, young people all over the borough of Staten Island would scare the living daylights out of each other with descriptions of the monstrous figure known only as Cropsey, supposedly a sort of boogeyman figure. With a razor-sharp steel hook for a hand, Cropsey would apparently drag innocent children from their homes in the middle of the night before carrying them to an abandoned hospital. There, depending on who was telling the story, you would be tortured, killed, eaten, or any combination of the three. Although creepy campfire and urban legends are a standard, a thrilling part of most everyone's early childhood, for the children of Staten Island, these ominous little tales soon became disquietingly real. The line between fact and fiction began to blur as local children began to vanish in real life, but when their cold, dead bodies were found, it made it clear that this was no mere campfire tale. Could it be that Cropsey was real? During the 1960s, Andre Rand was employed as a custodian at the Willowbrook State School. Funded by state government, the Willowbrook was a charitable center that provided aid for children with disabilities. On the surface, all of the Willowbrook's practices were good and proper, but upon closer inspection, state officials began to unravel a web of questionable conditions and unethical medical practices. On the advice of the inspectors, the Willowbrook was immediately closed and Andre Rand was forced to find alternative employment. Rand had a clean slate. He could have pursued just about any manner of unskilled labor, but instead, he chose to pursue an even more horrifying career. Between the date of the Willowbrook's closing in the early 1970s, several young girls went missing in the area surrounding the abandoned hospital. The first was a 5-year-old Alice Piera. On July 10, 1972, the happy-go-lucky toddler seemed to simply vanish into thin air while playing in the street just outside her house, a street located just a few miles southeast of the old Willowbrook Hospital. For a while, the whereabouts of the small child remained a complete mystery. Yet there was something else the local townsfolk were unaware of, that Andre Rand once went by Frank Rushon. And Frank Rushon had once served 10 months in prison for the abduction of several small children. The fact he only did 10 months stems from the fact that his defense attorney managed to essentially haggle a judge down to a conviction of false imprisonment, a crime with a considerably lower penalty than kidnap or abduction. But the conviction was enough to smear Frank's name for good, and so he came up with a rather simple and cunning solution. He changed it, and after moving out to Staten Island, became Andre Rand. Yet as much as Rand could hide his identity from the townsfolk, he couldn't hide his identity from police officers, who were well aware of his legal change of name. So when little Alice Pereira went missing on that warm July evening, the police considered Rand to be the prime suspect. Despite their convictions, evidence was flimsy and not nearly enough to gain a solid conviction in a court of law. And so, as the cops chose to hold their horses, the bodies began to pile up. On July 15, 1981, 7-year-old Holly Ann Hughes went missing. Her parents filed a missing persons report, while several witnesses claimed to have seen the girl with Rand shortly before her disappearance. Once again, no actual evidence led to no actual arrest. 2 years later, Rand once again became the prime suspect when 11-year-old Tyhees Jackson disappeared. Then in 1984, 21-year-old Hank Gaffario vanished. These unnerving incidents left the nearby townsfolk racked with terror, a terror that was exacerbated by the fact that not a single person was apprehended, with all at a loss for a potential motive. It was a whopping 3 years before local law enforcement finally caught a break in their investigation, when 12-year-old girl Jennifer Swagger was reported missing on July 9th of 1987. The search for her, or her body, lasted 35 days, and ended in the traumatic unearthing of her body in a wooded area on Staten Island. According to the New York Times, Swagger was found dead in a shallow grave on the former property of the Willowbrook State School. By the time Jenny Swagger's body was found, police decided they had to act, and Andre Rand was arrested and charged as a suspect in the murder. Once again, prosecutors fell afoul of court procedure and found they were unable to convict Rand on the murder charge, with there only being enough evidence to irrefutably convict him of kidnapping. This was 1988. Prosecutors had Rand exactly where they wanted him, in a federal penitentiary, where he'd stew while they worked on convicting him of the other child murders. Although there wasn't enough evidence at the time, Rand was found guilty of Holly Ann Hughes' kidnapping in 2004, over 2 decades after she originally went missing. And since there is no statute of limitations for New York for first-degree kidnapping, prosecutors ensured that Rand wouldn't escape justice for his historic depravities. He was given an additional 25 years to life sentence on top of the one he was already serving. All in all, the Staten Island boogeyman sits behind bars to this day for the kidnappings of Holly Ann Hughes and Jennifer Swagger, and won't be eligible for parole until 2037, provided he lives that long. He'll be 93 years old on the day he walks free. Andre Rand's disturbing life and legacy were dissected in the 2019 documentary movie Propsy. The film premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival that year and won the Grand Jury Prize for its enthralling narrative and slick production quality. And on watching it, it's easy to see why. The essential premise of the movie was to explore whether or the Staten Island urban legend of Cropsey was actually tied into Rand's murderous career. Whether one had fed into the other until fact and fiction had become indistinguishable. Yet as the movie came to show, for some of the people who experienced those years on Staten Island, as well as those involved in searching for the missing kids, the term boogeyman didn't even broach Rand's despicable psychopathy. Donna Cotugno, president of the charity Friends of the Jennifer for Missing Children, calls Rand the Hannibal Lecter of Staten Island. Donna and her fellow volunteers have the unenviable task of searching all over Willowbrook's 385 acres twice a year in search of any undiscovered remains. He terrified a whole community, and he still haunts us, Donna was quoted as saying. For some kids, it's like if Corpsey was real. What else aren't they telling us, you know? And I don't know, sometimes I feel a little of that too. At the end, Andre Rand was arrested, imprisoned, and may never see the light of day again. But nevertheless, his impact on the Staten Island community is immeasurable, and Cropsey has left behind massive psychological trauma that may well last for generations. Some of those children are still missing. The remains are still out there, somewhere. And as the years go by, and their bones are pulled one by one from the cold earth entombing them, the memories of Rand's reign of terror will come back flooding, over and over again. And maybe that's what makes the Cropsey story so well and truly terrifying, that the core lesson in the story, the frightful foundation of its message, is that the boogeyman is real, and he wears the faces of men. Perhaps you've heard of the urban legend sometimes known as the dead body under the bed. The legend tells of a vacationing couple that checks into a seedy roadside motel only to discover a foul smell in their room. Come night, they find the smell to be so odorous that they're unable to sleep and decide to call a member of staff to complain. This staff member then discovers that the smell is in fact coming from the bed, and looks under the frame to find the couple had been sleeping on top of the rotting body of a young girl that had been stuffed into the box. It's definitely one of the lesser known urban legends, but it's one made all the more terrifying by the fact that it's actually a true story. Not only that, but there have been multiple occurrences of people sleeping in rooms where dead bodies have been concealed, and two of those unfortunate souls were James and Rhonda Sargent. The couple had been on the road for hours before they checked into room 222 of the Budget Lodge Inn on Brooks Road in Memphis, Tennessee. That evening, the couple said they complained to the motel staff that the room was stanky and foul. They burned some incense they picked up from a nearby hippie hole, but it seemed like nothing could cover the revolting odor. Though it seemed that someone had apparently tried before, because the sergeants noticed there were fabric softener sheets stuffed into ceiling tiles and nooks, and the smell was strongest whenever anyone sat on the bed. It was perhaps the worst night's sleep of their entire lives. And in the morning, the couple left the motel, determined to never darken its doors again. Sometime later, the smell had attracted some negative attention that the motel owners finally decided to call the police. More than one guest had commented that it smells like a dead body in there, in room 222, and they weren't wrong. Homicide detectives instantly recognized the smell as belonging to a corpse, and after turning the room upside down, located the moldering cadaver of 28-year-old mother of four, Sony Millbrook. Throughout the course of the police investigation that followed, it was discovered that Sony had checked into the Budget Inn sometime in January of 2010. She was staying with her boyfriend and father of four of her children, Lakeith Moody, and the room was in his name. Millbrook had been there for a couple of weeks when one day in late January, she did not pick up her kids from daycare. Her sister, Linda James, reported her missing. Police believe she died the day she vanished, but were told by motel workers that they had bagged up Millbrook's personal belongings and cleaned the room. The workers said nothing appeared amiss and the room was rented out. If Sony had indeed been a victim of foul play, it certainly hadn't been the Budget Inn, or at least so it seemed. After Sony's body was found, Lakeith Moody was stopped while driving Millbrook's car and was arrested on federal charges of being a felon in possession of a gun. It took until his trial in 2014 for him to be convicted of murdering the mother of his child, and he was automatically given a life sentence in accordance with state law. I'm just a shock because I'm like, okay, I done laid on top of this lady's body, said Rhonda Sargent, who stayed in the room after Millbrook disappeared, before her body was found. This is somebody's daughter, someone's mom. Why didn't they investigate this fully? I think I would have searched all over, her husband James added. I think I would have known to look up under the bed. Yet he didn't, and neither did the police. It was already clear. Talk about ruining a crime scene, Memphis Police Director Larry Godwin said in March. It had also been rented several times with next to no complaints. It was like, well, we don't have any evidence here. The officers wanted to solve it, and so they went in a different direction. Whether or not there was misfortune, or simply incompetence on the part of investigating police, it's impossible to judge. But what things remain clear, that an alarming number of people have actually slept on beds under which a body had been concealed. So next time you're on the road, and you stop to spend the night at a roadside rest stop, make sure there's nothing masking any particular nasty smells. And as always, always check under the bed, as apparently, you know really well when you'll be sleeping with an unexpected roommate. Ironically, one of the most horrifying true urban legends is perhaps one of the least known, at least in the US anyway. Because up in Toronto, Canada, almost everyone has heard the story of the Leaping Lawyer. According to the story, one well-to-do lawyer was overly keen on showing off all the features of his extravagant office space. Set into a huge glass skyscraper, the firm who made the huge plate glass windows of the office boasts that their windows were unbreakable, and that it would take a shot from an artillery gun to successfully shatter them. Apparently, this well-to-do lawyer was a fan of proving them right, and had a rather terrifying office party trick that he often used to wow his guests. Right when the party was in full swing, he would take a running jump at the plate glass windows after announcing, "Goodbye, cruel world." Those in attendance would scream in horror as the lawyer leapt towards the window, only to be met with his hysterical laughter when he harmlessly bounced off the toughened, polished glass. Over and over, the lawyer repeated his death-defying stunt, until one day, the unthinkable happened, and the unbreakable broke. The lawyer reeled up, ran at the glass, thrilled by the accompanying screams of the uninitiated. But as his large, speeding body came in contact with the glass, it shattered. Instead of turning around to laugh at those who had fallen for the prank, the lawyer was only met with the sound of his own screams as he plummeted 20 stories down to his death. It's an urban legend that has everything. The impossible is possible. The arrogant are punished. And it's about as theatrical as urban legends get. Yet perhaps the real horror only comes when we learn that the entire story is completely and utterly true. After completing an engineering degree before attending law school, Gary Hoy took a job practicing corporate and securities law in the eastern Canadian city of Toronto. He worked for a firm known as Holden Day Wilson, a law firm located on the 24th floor of the Toronto Dominion Centre. Then on July 9, 1993, Hoy happened to notice someone giving a tour of the office to a group of articling students from a nearby university. Like he had done many times before, he attempted to demonstrate the strength of the structure's window glass by slamming himself into a window. So, in order to give the students a good fright, Hoy took his usual run up and slammed into the plate glass. This is where the urban legend differs from the true story, as it turns out the glass was indeed unbreakable and remained unshattered even on the day of Hoy's death. Instead, some rusty old screws, tired of Hoy's continual abuses, simply dislodged and allowed the window pane to slip out of place. Right there, in front of the completely unsuspecting students, Gary Hoy screamed as he slipped through the gap in the floor and the window, plummeting 24 stories to his death. The building's structural engineer, Bob Greer, was contacted by the Toronto Star for comment. When he learned of Hoy's folly, he was quoted as saying, "I don't know of a single building code in the entire world that would allow a 160-pound man to run up against a window like that. He must have been out of his freaking mind." In another interview, the glass company who made the panes was quick to state that the windows didn't actually break. "We just want to make that clear. It popped out of its frame. That's what caused Mr. Hoy to fall. Shoddy workmanship, not our product." Holden Day Wilson never recovered from Hoy's death, and it was definitely one of the factors that contributed to the firm's eventual closure less than 3 years later. At the time, it was the largest law firm closure in Canadian history, but national newspapers seemed to forget that Hoy's death even occurred. The firm's closure was blamed on mismanagement and financial discrepancies, and the fact that Gary's ghost had haunted all those that had witnessed his death was totally ignored. Maybe that's because the story became so frequently mentioned in fictional media, referenced so heavily on TV and in film, that people just assumed it was the fabrication of some overly imaginative writer. And we can understand why. The tale is truly a horrifying one, something we'd rather tell ourselves didn't happen, rather than facing the bone-chilling truth that a man really did end up taking his own life, all because of a dumb prank.